It's the climate talks in Paris this weekend, as you are doubtless aware. And we've been meaning for some time to talk to Tim Hollow, who, apart from being a member of 4Play, is also the founder of Green Music Australia. You'll find out what all of that means in a moment when we talk to Tim. Let's listen, though, first to 4Play. This is Mississippi Sinkhole.
Mississippi sinkhole.
That's a piece called Mississippi Sinkhole, and it was performed by 4Play. Lara Goodridge was doing the singing and playing violin. Playing cello was Peter Hollow. Playing viola, Shenzo Gregorio. And because 4Play is that rare bird, a string quartet with two viola players, playing the other viola was Peter's brother, Tim Hollow. Now, Tim Hollow is joining us via Skype from Cambridge. And Tim, welcome back to the music show.
Thank you very much for having me.
Now, we're talking to you partly because it's always nice to talk to 4Play and to hear 4Play, but also because of the talks in Paris about climate. You are very vocal and very busy, actually, on behalf of Green Music Australia, which you founded. Maybe you could tell us briefly what this is.
Sure. Well, Green Music Australia comes from two places, I guess. The first is as a musician gigging around the place and touring and getting frustrated by the environmental impact of the music industry. You know, we're an industry full of forward-thinking, caring people, and yet we have festivals which are strewn with rubbish, and we have an energy-guzzling venues and studios, and we have massive transport emissions. I mean, we're nothing like a coal industry or an aluminium industry, but we should be able to do better. And virtually every musician I talk to agrees. And the other side is as a long-term environmental activist, getting increasingly frustrated that we're not getting anywhere and we need to try new ways in. So the idea of Green Music Australia was born from both of those directions, to form an organisation which could facilitate practically the greening of the music industry and help venues and studios and festivals and individual musicians to reduce their own environmental impact. And through doing so, create some social change as well, because musicians, we're in this incredibly privileged position of being able to speak to very large numbers of people through a very powerful medium.
Well, you've raised quite a few different issues there, but perhaps we'll come to back to the music in a moment, the music itself. There's sort of two sides to this, isn't there? There's the kind of rather basic one, which is sort of don't drop rubbish at music festivals. And obviously, I mean, that just makes complete sense. Apart from anything else, it looks horrible. And that's something that everybody can do. But there's also, as you suggest, a sort of deeper issue here, which is much more, I suppose, political. And of course, I should have mentioned that you were involved in politics as director of communications for Christine Milne when she was leader of the Greens. So how do musicians engage with this deeper level of the political level, if you like, of the green movement?
Look, there's all sorts of ways. From the very, very obvious in terms of playing at events, for instance, like the climate marches that are going to be happening this coming weekend, you know, through to writing and performing protest songs for those for whom that's of interest, and that's always going to be a small number, I imagine. But there's in fact a very much deeper layer of politics that I've always believed is in fact a much more powerful one than simply talking about issues. And that involves engaging at an emotional level with ideas. And that's what music can do in some very interesting ways. It's a transcendent form of communication. It goes beyond words and really opens up our hearts and our minds to different ideas. So I'm fascinated by the role that music can play in that way. And as musicians, if we take practical action to reduce our environmental impact while playing music, I think there's a great potential to create some really deep social change there.
I suppose some people would suggest that the music sugarcoats the politics, that it makes it more palatable, the message. Is that part of it?
That's one way of looking at it. I think the music creates an atmosphere in which people can open their minds to thinking in different ways. There's a stream of political communications thought around this concept called framing, that people don't actually change their minds on political ideas based on facts and based on rational decision making. It's generally based on the view that they have of the world, the frames through which they view the world. And part of that is a concept called priming. And that if you want to change the view that people have of the world, you need to prime them to be able to make that shift. And that can be through anything as simple as smiling while you're talking, for instance. That's why politicians smile a lot, because they know that if they're smiling, then you'd be more likely to listen to what they have to say. But it can go a lot deeper than that. And music, I think, is one of the most powerful ways of doing that. And there's some fascinating research around it.
Now, that I've always been slightly scared, actually, when politicians smile. Apart from anything else, you can see their teeth.
Yeah, very true. Very true.
Sorry, come back but to your research.
There's actually some fascinating research around the extent to which simply smiling can change the perception of what you're saying. But with music, there's, I mean, film composers, for instance, have known forever and a day the impact that a small amount of quiet music can have on the emotional feelings that you have when viewing a particular piece of film. That's why advertising music is so powerful as well. Music is an amazing prime in that way. It can help you shift very deeply the way you see the world. In fact, it can shift your perspective quite dramatically.
So we're talking about, two different things, aren't we? First of all, as you mentioned some time ago, protest songs. That's very clear. That's when, you know, the singer puts the message across in the words. But you're talking about something not subliminal, but certainly at a more subtle level, aren't you? So, but it's something, you know, that, again, you can imagine that there will be people who think, well, that's like trickery, you know, that music is sucking me in. And I'm sort of, you know, this is what happens in the supermarket aisle, isn't it? You there's that quiet music and you sort of walk along like an automaton, just taking cans off shelves and putting them in your trolley.
Well, absolutely. One of the fascinating things about music is I think it's a tool that can be used for all sorts of ends and is. Political music, I mean, you see the broad sweep from 60s use of music in the civil rights movement and the early feminism movement, all the way through to the use of hyper-militaristic music by the Nazis and the apartheid regime, and through to the use of music in advertising jingles. It's been seen, it's been understood by people throughout human history, frankly, as a way in which we can reach each other in different ways, I think. And yes, you can see it as trickery, but I actually believe that it's actually understanding human communication at a very deep way. Music is one of the first ways that humans learn to communicate between each other. It predates humanity in terms of mating calls and territorial marking and bonding, group bonding. It's a pre-human instinct to help us understand who we are and understand how we relate to the others around us. And because of that, it's part of our identity. It's part of the way we find ourselves in society. And if we can use that, it might seem underhand, but if we can use that to help protect the environment, I think we're doing a good thing through it.
You're listening to The Music Show on RN, and I'm talking to Tim Hollow, who is a viola player and one quarter of the string quartet Foreplay, and also an environmental activist. I read something that Billy Bragg wrote recently suggesting that musicians don't bring about change, audience members do, and that maybe all the musical activist can do is encourage from the stage or make the audience members feel that they're not alone.
Yes, I think his commentary on these issues is always fascinating and very wise. And that's one of the things that I've been very keen to work on through Green Music Australia is musicians aren't climate scientists or ecologists. You know, we're not experts in this field. But by getting up on a stage and saying, this is something that I care about, this is something I understand, and I want to create some change on it myself, it's not, absolutely, it's not musicians changing the world, but it's musicians helping, as Billy Bragg would say, the audience to do it themselves. And frankly, that's the same for politics.
But I imagine that people who go to Billy Bragg concerts or who go to WOM Adelaide, for instance, even if they do drop litter on the grass in Botanic Park, I imagine that they don't really, I mean, there are not very many of them, you know, are in favour of wailing. We're talking about an audience which is pretty much on side already. But when you get to another level of fame, it's not necessarily true. And I remember talking to Peter Garrett about this on the music show, long before he became a professional politician, asking him, I mean, there must be a lot of people in a Midnight Oil concert who are not politically sympathetic to Peter Garrett and the other members of the Oils. And when you get to that level of fame, you are, in fact, in a sense, not just preaching to the converted, are you? You've also got people out there who are either ignoring the words or perhaps don't understand the words.
There's a couple of really fascinating issues there. In terms of preaching to the converted, the wonderful Tim Levinson, Earth Boy, great DJ and huge force behind the hip-hop scene in Australia. When I was talking to him recently, he said preaching to the choir is one of the most underappreciated aspects of what music can do to help social change. And I think he's dead right. As he puts it, one of the vital roles of music is to be the band behind the choir. It's to inspire people who do care to keep caring and to keep acting. So I think we really shouldn't underestimate the importance of that. When you go to a festival which does have a really strong environmental ethic like WOM Adelaide, there's a really deep bonding that can occur there through the music and through the fact that it is actually a very clean site, and you know that it's powered by renewable energy, and that they're not selling disposable cutlery or using disposable cutlery and plates and that kind of thing. So that it's really actually important that that happens. In terms of the people who aren't already on side, there's a couple of different things at play. I think one is that it's very unlikely to be damaging to the cause. But secondly, it can actually help to attract new people to it. You know, people in the atmosphere of a Midnight Oil gig who might not have really grappled with ideas of nuclear disarmament or Indigenous rights or anything, you know, like those major issues that they were singing about. I've no doubt that for some people it helped create something of a political awakening.
Yeah, well, but it's also possible to misunderstand the words of a song so badly that, you know, you end up using a Springsteen song to introduce a Republican candidate to the stage. And this is happening all the time. I mean, with the Reclaim Australia movement here, almost every other week, some benighted singer or songwriter has to go public and say, stop using my songs, they're not for you. And if you listen to the words, you'll discover that actually they are critical of your standpoint.
And, you know, how fascinating is that that's been happening with Reclaim Australia? I actually think it's one of the most incredible examples of a misguided misappropriation of other people's art backfiring badly. Mm. They thought that they were going to be able to use K-San or, you know, Holy Grail to get some of the shine of those fabulous iconic rock songs to come off on them, whereas in fact you've had Jimmy Barnes and John Schumann and Mark Seymour come out and extremely passionately tear them apart. So I think that, yes, absolutely, songs can be co-opted. People's music can be co-opted for all sorts of purposes, and sometimes it works. In this case, I think we've seen it backfire very badly indeed.
I think we have. Look, it's been very interesting to talk to you, Tim. There is a great deal more we could talk about. Very briefly, a word about divestment, because this is happening more and more at an individual level. Musicians deciding that they are going to abandon banks that that invest in fossil fuels. But it's also happening on a very high level with APRA, the Performing Rights Society, recently announcing that it's doing something very similar.
Yes, look, the fossil fuel divestment campaign has just taken off around the world in the last couple of years. With this very simple principle, as stated by Bill McKibben, the American activist, that if it's wrong to wreck the climate, it's wrong to profit from that wreckage. And if you have money with a bank which is still continuing to invest in coal mining in the face of climate change, then you should move it to a bank which won't. So the musicians' divestment movement came really from conversations between myself and a couple of others, Felix Reibel from the Cat Empire, Missy Higgins, Ash Grunwald, who were all keen to get involved in this. So we got a lot of musicians showing interest very, very fast, one of whom being the great Australian composer Nigel Westlake, who's very heavily involved in APRA. And APRA came on board very quickly. They said, yes, this is absolutely right. I think Brett Cottle, their CEO, made a beautiful point when he said, I'm not quoting him directly, but essentially what he said was, we're now past the stage where passively sitting by and accepting inaction on climate change is acceptable. So I think we're going to see people across the political spectrum start to move on an issue like divestment. The massive insurance company Allianz announced just this week that they were divesting from fossil fuels as well. So, yeah, it's been really exciting and inspiring to see APRA come on board with this. And they're an industry organisation which takes its social and environmental responsibilities very seriously, which is a great thing for the music industry.
Thank you very much indeed for talking to us, Tim Hollow. This is obviously a subject, a very, very big subject, music and politics, that we should return to more often. But for the time being, I'll let you get to bed. It's way past your bedtime. Thanks for talking to us by Skype from Cambridge. Tim Hollow.
Thank you very much for having me.
And if you want to follow up any of the ideas in that interview, if you go to the Music Show's website, there will be some links to click, not least one to Green Music Australia. And that's it for today's Music Show. On next weekend, we will have Zulia and the Children of the Underground. It's always good to have Zulia on. We'll talk to Elena Katz-Chernin. She has a flute concerto, which is having its second performance next weekend, and also her long-awaited TV opera called Divorce is going to air. And we'll also talk to the Darwin Symphony Orchestra, or at least their conductor, they're remembering Cyclone Tracy. This week's music shows were produced by Maureen Cooney and Penny Lomax and Delia Bartle, technical production by Marty Peralta, Alex Stinson and Lila Schooner.